On episode 33 of the Guadalajara Geopolitics podcast, we interviewed Dr. Stephen Kinzer, who is an award-winning journalist, author, and academic. He is known as among the best in popular foreign policy storytelling. He writes articles for the Boston Globe, and his most recent book is The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. He has spent more than 20 years reporting for the New York Times on conflicts abroad as a foreign correspondent, and he is a visiting fellow at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. In this episode, we discuss U.S. foreign policy and interventionism and ask the question, is U.S. foreign policy a major cause in global destabilization? Thank you, Dr. Stephen Kinzer, for joining the podcast this morning. It seems to me that one of the most destabilizing forces in the world today is U.S. foreign policy and its interventionism. Of your numerous books, you've written Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. The list is long, as you detail in that book, but we have everything from U.S. coups in Ukraine and Brazil today directed against Russia and the BRICS, and Syrian regime change in a bid to remake the Middle East. Would you agree that U.S. foreign policy is a major cause in global destabilization? And could you discuss your thoughts on that?
Americans tend to approach the world in a very particular way. We believe we have a providential mission to guide the world, to shape the world. And we think we've been given a special insight into how societies should be run. We believe that the model that has been successful for us is a universal model, and it should be best for everyone. If there are countries in the world that don't seem to want our model or resist it, that often seems to us to be only proof of how backward those people are, that they don't even realize how much they need to be like us. In the minds of many Americans, everyone in the world is essentially an incomplete American and is hoping for some help to develop fully to become a real American. As far as we believe, that's the goal of everyone on Earth. We tend to think that if there are countries that resist our power, it must be because people in that country have been misled by a group of thuggish or dishonest or criminal leaders, and that if we can only remove those leaders, the natural desire of people all over the world to be like America and embrace American power would flower. This leads us to interventions in countries around the world. The United States has intervened more often in more countries further from our own borders than any other nation on Earth. These interventions are launched sometimes with the idea that they will help the target country and sometimes with the idea that they will help the United States, usually both. In the end, however, many of these interventions wind up undermining American national security and weakening or even devastating the target countries. They don't wind up good for the United States or for anyone else. Nonetheless, it's a habit the Americans are finding a great deal of trouble breaking. We're used to believing that there is a world system and the United States is the system operator. Particularly during the Cold War, we got into this view that we were indispensable. Many American foreign policy makers still believe this. They believe that without the United States, there will be chaos in the world, and that it is our role to shape and guide the world. Many in Washington don't understand, and I think are genuinely puzzled at how people in some parts of the world think that we're a bully. We feel like we're only helping other people. It's difficult for us to see ourselves as others see us.
And it began centuries ago with Monroe Doctrine and then on to Manifest Destiny, as you alluded to, and American exceptionalism. And it just seems like a crescendo that keeps getting bigger and bigger, this idea of Americans. And yourself, people like yourself and I, we kind of snap out of it and you just think, it's common sense. We'll come to the realization that we shouldn't quite be operating the world system. And what about our current situation it seems precarious with the NATO missile bases that are being built in Eastern Europe that I suppose are targeting Russia, and similar systems that are being set up in the Southeast Asia and around Korea and Japan targeting China. Russian playwright Anton Chekhov stated that if in the first act you have a gun, it must go off by the end of the play. Do you think we are at risk for a new and truly dangerous global conflict or series of conflicts?
You mentioned the Monroe Doctrine, which of course was a proclamation by the United States saying that outside powers have no business interfering in the Western Hemisphere. Sometime after the Monroe Doctrine was proclaimed, President Theodore Roosevelt added what was called the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. That corollary said that if any country in the Western Hemisphere was misbehaving, in the judgment of the United States, we would arrogate to ourselves what was called an international police power, and we would take on the responsibility of intervening in that country and changing the situation to one that we liked. Over the more recent times, what we have effectively done is extended the Monroe Doctrine and the Roosevelt Corollary to the whole world. What we've essentially said is that no other country should have the right to intervene in nations beyond its own borders, other than the United States, and that if any do, if there's any trouble anywhere in the world that we judge worthy of response, we should take on the international police power and go in and fix it to our liking. Needless to say, other countries in the world resist this. This view has led us to a foreign policy that's highly confrontational. We have a militarized foreign policy rather than a foreign policy based on diplomacy. In recent years, this policy has led us into strong and escalating disputes, particularly with China and Russia. Right now, I look at the world and I see the growing tension in Eastern Europe as a serious danger to world peace. You have tit-for-tat escalations along the Russian border as the NATO alliance, dominated by the United States, is carrying out highly visible military maneuvers close and in some cases directly on the borders of Russia. Russia has naturally responded by reinforcing its bases along its own borders. We in the United States are expecting Russia to accept a military posture which we Americans would never accept from Russia. The United States would never tolerate Russian military exercises in Quebec. We would not allow Mexico to open a Chinese military base in Tijuana. Of course, Mexico is a sovereign country and Canada is a sovereign country, but that has some limits. So we all understand that countries need strategic depth. They can't afford to have hostile military power right on their borders. And that concern has to do with real existential national security threats. That tends to override legalistic principles about national security. If you were living in Honduras or Guatemala over a past century or so, you would have a strong understanding of how limited is national sovereignty of a small country when it lives next to a big power. The United States is feeding an escalation in our relationship with Russia, which is very troubling. It extends from Eastern Europe all the way to the Middle East. These two countries are also nuclear armed, and we are pushing our military forces into each other's faces so directly that I think you'd have to consider today the threat of conflict between the United States and Russia certainly greater than at any time since the Cold War.
And this is a difficult question, but let's put ourselves in Russia's shoes. If you were Vladimir Putin, who is supported by according to the polls, 80 to 90% of the Russian people. How would you react to Washington's current actions against Russia and Russia's allies? Do you think Putin is having a common sense, conservative reaction approach? What would be a proper, logical, and necessary response if we were Russians?
If any leader of Russia today were to look at NATO operations in Central and Eastern Europe and simply respond by shrugging his shoulders and saying something like, well, that's outside our borders, therefore it's no concern of ours, there would be a rebellion in Moscow. That would be an unpardonable breach of the responsibilities of any Russian president. You have a hostile military alliance carrying out provocative exercises right on your border. A Russian leader could not possibly ignore that. We are putting Putin in a position where he has to take strongly nationalistic and militaristic positions, because those are essentially the positions that we're supporting on the other side. We're feeding the escalation, and I really don't see how we could expect Russia to react any differently from the way it is reacting. It wouldn't be logical in terms of national security for Russia to ignore the intense enemy military activity right on its borders.
And let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the American public and media that makes all of these conflicts possible as a factor. And as a note to Muhammad Ali, I'd like to mention your recent piece, Don't Mythologize Ali's Rage, in the Boston Globe. And you write how Ali was hated at the time and called anti-American. And I teach mostly non-American students, and the majority would agree with the viewpoint espoused by yourself and Muhammad Ali. Yet one or two Americans I come across over the years, react viciously and defame me exactly as they did Muhammad Ali. And people like yourself must receive harsh criticism over the years. In fact, I pulled up a quote from your bio on Wikipedia, which isn't very objective and seems to be a pot shot. It says, in 2016, Dr. Kinzer wrote on the Syrian civil war, repeating the Assad and Putin regime view of events, Kinzer has not himself reported from Syria, and his views are widely divergent from reporters like, etc.
I haven't seen that, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah. And you also wrote in your Syrian piece a few months ago that Americans are said to be ignorant of the world. Our ignorance is more dangerous because we act on it. The U.S. has the power to decree the death of nations. It can do so with popular support because many Americans and journalists are content with the official story. It is also likely to prolong the war and condemn more Syrians to suffering and death. So what is it about the American psyche that goes along with the war propaganda and makes interventionism possible?
First of all, I think there is a syndrome that is natural to all nations and not peculiar to the United States. Countries at war tend to be very intolerant. There's always the impulse in any country to think that once there's a national security threat, and particularly if there's a hot war underway, all criticism of the government, and particularly its security policy, must cease. In the United States, that effectively would mean that all criticism of American foreign policy would have to cease forever, because we are now engaged in what seems like a forever war. I teach college students who can't remember any time when the United States was not at war. If you want to accept the view that during war, governments shouldn't be criticized, then there shouldn't be any criticism in the United States. Beyond that, I think there are some factors that are particular to the United States. We feel that we are spreading good in the world, and we hate the idea that people anywhere are suffering. Americans are very compassionate people. When we are told that civilians are being bombed or girls who want to go to school are being attacked, we react emotionally. We want to help those people. Our leaders understand this aspect of our compassionate personality, and they play on it. Every time American leaders want to intervene for whatever reason in any country in the world, they like to cloak the intervention in a humanitarian garb. They know that this is the argument that persuades most Americans. Innocent people are suffering, and therefore it's the role of the United States to go in and stop the suffering. Here I see a problem in perception. In the United States, we tend to think that as human rights emergencies in the world become more acute, the argument for American intervention grows. In other words, if the situation is not so bad and there's not so much suffering, maybe we don't have to intervene. But if many people are being killed and there's a terrible human rights emergency, then we should intervene. I don't think this is the right standard to use. The right standard should be the argument for our intervention becomes more persuasive, not when the situation in another country becomes worse, but when the possibility that we can actually improve the situation grows. We don't stop to ask ourselves that question. Is our intervention actually going to achieve the humanitarian objectives we want to achieve? We just assume that when we intervene, we're going to produce the result that we want. Now, over the last years, as a result of our interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya, a growing number of Americans have come to question this impulse. I think there is now an understanding as a result of those disasters that American intervention doesn't always work out the way we imagine it will. We wonder now, is this just a momentary pendulum swing and Americans will return to instinctive interventionism very soon? Or have we learned a lesson that will stick with us over a longer period, and will we now become a little more hesitant to intervene abroad? The verdict is still out on that. I think that certainly with the likelihood of Hillary Clinton as president of the United States will return to a much more forceful, interventionist, confrontational policy. I think if you don't like confrontational nature of our relationship with Russia now, you will hate it in a few years, because Hillary Clinton is a confrontational person by nature and intensely anti-Russian. The confrontation in Central Europe will undoubtedly intensify. Whether Hillary Clinton will be able to bring the American people along with her in that policy is uncertain. Interestingly enough, it's Donald Trump who has suggested that maybe it would be better for us to deal with Putin rather than try to push a stick into his eye. That is not a universally accepted view here. I do think that the presidential campaign, thanks in part to Trump but also to Bernie Sanders, has opened up debate over foreign policy issues that were never debated before. The question, for example, of NATO's role in the future has never been discussed in American politics. It's an absolute taboo to suggest that there should be any changes in NATO or American participation in NATO. That taboo has been broken for the first time during this presidential election campaign. You have also heard for the first time in major American presidential candidates suggesting that we might consider the views of the Palestinians when looking at the Middle East. That was considered a death sentence for any politician in America. Expressions of sympathy for the Palestinians were also a strict taboo. Now, we saw that the candidates who suggested taking into account Palestinian concerns were not punished by voters. So I do think that at least in some segments of the American population, there's a little bit of rethinking going on about the utility of these endless interventions.
And what would be the importance of Martin Luther King Jr., who you mentioned in the article, and Muhammad Ali and their legacy? We need more of people like them, don't we?
I like people who don't feel bound by the strictures and taboos of traditional discourse. I remember the Martin Luther King era. I was a kid then, but I was, of course, intensely following Martin Luther King. And I remember quite vividly that for most of his career, he focused exclusively on his campaign for the civil rights of African Americans. During that period, although he was widely hated in many places, he was also greatly admired by the large mass of the liberal elite. Then, towards the end of his life, he decided to move to another level and start criticizing American foreign policy. He denounced the Vietnam War in very strong terms. That was a turning point. That was the moment when King seemed to step outside the boundaries of the role that society felt comfortable with him playing. And that began turning many people against him. So it shows you that once you tread on delicate toes, you step outside the mainstream. And this is particularly true when you criticize the way American forces bomb and invade and occupy other countries.
And I think that the work and services you provide are essential to combating war propaganda and policies that eventually end up killing millions. And I think what you are doing is part of the solution to this problem. In fact, in your recent piece on revitalizing our vital interests, you give a short and simple list of what America should stop doing in order to make the world a safer place. Could you review some of those vital interests that America should give up on?
As a general rule, all countries have interests, and that list of interests can be very long. But within that list, there should be a very small list of vital interests. Your vital interests are interests for which you will go to war. So you want to keep that list as short as possible. The United States, however, has a very long list of vital interests, and traditionally we have thought that we have vital interests everywhere. In the past, we thought that if Iran nationalized its oil industry or Guatemala decreed land reform, that would be an existential threat to the United States, and we had to react because a vital interest of ours was being threatened. In the more modern age, we seem to imagine that we have vital interests everywhere. For example, we have a vital interest to maintain our dominant position in the Persian Gulf. Just to use that as an example, there may have been a time when that was a vital interest for us, but it isn't anymore. We don't need to maintain the friendship of Arab countries to confront the Soviet Union. And we don't need to maintain that friendship in order to maintain our oil supplies. Nonetheless, our foreign policies change very slowly. The world has changed. Our foreign policies have not. The fact is, we are providing security in the Persian Gulf, not for ourselves, but essentially for the countries that export oil from the Persian Gulf, which is mainly India and China and, to a certain extent, Japan. They're not paying to secure the Persian Gulf. The United States is paying for that. That is not a vital interest of ours. Then there are other social issues which we think of as vital interests. It's a vital interest of ours that girls in Afghanistan be able to go to school or gay rights be observed in Uganda. In fact, these are not vital interests. We need to focus our vital interest list much more narrowly. So what would be America's vital interest? The United States has to be sure that it is never attacked with weapons of mass destruction. We need to be sure that wars in other countries don't spill onto our borders and into our territory. We need to maintain trade routes on which our economy depends. I would add that we need to confront climate change as a way to prevent deep disasters for our country over the midterm future. But after that, I think I'd like to stop. I don't want to make the list of vital interests too long. So a great policy for the United States would be making a list of the vital interests we think we have and crossing off most of them.
And for Americans and non-Americans alike, what other solutions would you recommend or exist to solve the problem of the current turn towards war and U.S. interventionism? You know, continue this discussion and hope more people, it enters into the public arena. What other solutions would you suggest?
I would like to see our foreign policy shift more to diplomacy rather than military. Power within the United States government of the military and the defense contractor complex is immense. There are more members of American military bands than there are diplomats in the U.S. State Department. That reflects the imbalance of the way we approach the world. We have, as Americans, a deep suspicion of diplomacy. Diplomacy, by its nature, requires compromise. And Americans are not used to compromising. We're used to getting our way. And this goes back to, I think, a larger problem that it is very serious for the United States. And it's adjusting to our new place in the world. Over generations, Americans have assimilated the idea that we rule the world. And for a long time, we did. But now, as the world has changed, our perception still has not changed. Our relative power in the world is going to be declining naturally as other countries grow. That requires a policy of cooperation because we can't dictate to the world the way we once could. American leaders are reluctant to acknowledge this reality and try to continue behaving as if the world still looks the way it did at the height of the Cold War. By failing to adjust our foreign policy to the new realities of a multipolar world, we are not defending our position, but actually weakening it.
And final thought that I always ask our guests is, for students, for young people, or people interested in these topics, do you have any tips or advice as they enter and, you know, they're faced with this propaganda from all different levels? Any advice or tips or words of wisdom as they begin to study these issues and honestly want to look for the truth and so they could better mankind?
My main advice is think independently. Do not accept uncritically the narrative of the world that is presented to you. Historians tell us in books which events of the past were important and which were less important. But that's only one person's judgment. Every individual can decide. Actually, those events that are portrayed in history books as hugely important might not be as important as other events and episodes about which we know very little. When we look at the world, our leaders give us a lens to do that. They tell us who's good, who's bad, what is the role of our country. I think it's very important for citizens to resist those narratives. Create your own narrative. Look at the facts on your own. Don't accept the lens that power gives you. We're all endowed with the ability to reason for ourselves. In foreign policy, we often seem to surrender that endowment. So I urge people to look critically at the official narrative. Don't swallow it and think for yourself.
Well, we thank you for your time, Dr. Kinzer, and this excellent discussion.
Thank you for having me.